Very good. The court earlier was called to order, and we then took a short recess, and now we are ready for the second case on today's oral argument calendar. The second case today is number A23-321, State of Minnesota versus Jerry DeAngelo Williams and Midwest Bonding LLC, which is the appellant in the on appeal. Counsel, I expect that you're familiar with our usual procedures as well as our procedures during Zoom arguments. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. You should be able to see the time clock on your screen if you're using the gallery view. So that will keep you informed about the time remaining in your argument. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I'm presuming everybody can see and hear me okay.
Yes, we can.
Thank you. My name is Jim McGeaney. I'm the attorney for the appellant in this matter, Midwest Bonding LLC, in this appeal from a district court order imposing a $200,000 penalty on the reinstatement and discharge of a previously forfeited bail bond. And may please.
I just want to, you say penalty. I don't think it was described as a penalty, was it?
I guess I don't know what else to call it other than a penalty that when the court reinstates
It's
a portion of the
called a
bond.
forfeiture, isn't it?
Well, I think the forfeiture was the original order from the court forfeiting the bond, and then the court reinstated a portion of the bond, and didn't reinstate the rest. So I suppose you could call it the continued forfeiture, but I think the cases and the theory of the Supreme Court out of Shatsky would categorize the retention of 200,000 of a $300,000 bail bond as the continued forfeiture. I would call that a penalty. I
Well,
guess it's
if it's a penalty,
semantics.
then you would prevail, correct?
I think so. That's
Okay.
my argument today, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay.
This is a unique case, if it please the court and counsel. I'll go forward with my argument. I'd like to start with the premise that the district court judge did agree that the Shatsky factors weighed in favor of reinstatement and discharge of the bond, in that the court reinstated and discharged a portion of the originally forfeited bail bond. Although in its memorandum, it does take some issues with the findings. I'd like to start with the fourth Shatsky factor, prejudice to the state. And the reason I want to start with that is because of the procedural posture of this case. The initial petition was filed, and then a hearing was requested by my office when the court denied the petition. And the attorney for the state failed to appear at the hearing and instead asked for a briefing schedule to make argument against the petition in writing,
Mr.
which we did.
McGeaney, just so I'm clear about this, I want to understand. Am I correct in understanding that an assistant county attorney attended the hearing? It was simply not the person assigned to the case, and the second attorney requested a continuance for the first attorney to do the briefing. Am I correct in that understanding?
You are, Your Honor. What happened was an attorney appeared and advised the court that it was not their case and that the assigned attorney was unable to appear at the hearing and was requesting a briefing schedule.
Okay, thank you.
And so the matter was briefed to the district court, and then the district court ultimately issued its order, which is an addendum 1 through 8. Our issue with some of the arguments on prejudice were that we're criticized in respondents' brief for not, demanding a hearing to prevent a factual record, but we were unaware of the allegations that were ultimately made in the state's written argument in the district court about their prejudice. There was no responsive pleadings filed or other affidavits in the initial.
That is true, but wasn't the individual on behalf of the state an officer of the court, and aren't those statements or written notations to the court, aren't those considered with the same degree of the weight, I want to say, that the court decides to give it?
I would say no. It's well established in Minnesota law that, and it's in the jury instructions in most trials, that statements of attorneys are not evidence. And that the state, this is a civil proceeding like any other civil proceeding. The state had ample time to file responsive pleadings in the district court action before the hearing was scheduled, and any affidavits in opposition to the petition. It's a civil matter, and the rules of civil procedure indicate that if they were going to present argument or evidence, that they have an obligation to present that in into the record and not merely assert it in a written submission to the court like in any other civil matter. Well, I appreciate attorneys or officers of the court.
Okay, but help me with this one. Was that what the process that was agreed upon, that instead of having evidence presented, that there were going to be written submissions?
I would not agree with the first assertion, because we had already submitted our evidence, which was a sworn affidavit, which is sufficient in a civil matter in the district court, and it was unrefuted. So we had submitted our affidavit to the district court in our initial pleadings. The state merely asked that they have a briefing schedule. They didn't ask for an extension of the time to file affidavits or evidence, or ask for a hearing to present any evidence. And then in their written submission made arguments that were not supported by any evidentiary support in the district court record. So I think that it wasn't agreed upon that the case would proceed without submission of any more evidence. The request was from the respondent's trial counsel to set a briefing schedule. And we didn't oppose that because we had already submitted our record and made our record. And by doing so, it forecloses on the opportunity to rebut the assertions other than in writing of what the state is alleging here. And they alleged that they were prejudiced in this case by loss of witnesses. And that's, in our opinion, just not supported by the record. It's merely an assertion. And if they were going to support that, if they were going to assert that, they had ample opportunity to file an affidavit to that effect from their victim witness coordinator or some other person familiar with the case. It also kind of defies logic that the state and the court found that the state was prejudiced, and yet the matter resolved in a plea agreement. So I'm not sure how, prejudice is the inability to prosecute the case. The case was prosecuted successfully, according to the court's footnote on addendum 8.
Well, it's not illogical to me, because it could be that the lack of a witness was a significant factor in plea negotiations. It could be that, and I don't know what the result of the, I don't know what count was pled to or what the negotiations were like, but it seems possible that that contributed to the plea rather than perhaps further prosecution. But anyway, I don't mean to make the state's argument for them on that. I just want to respond to your, is that a fair point? Let me ask you the question. Is that a fair point that it could have, the absence of the witness could have impacted plea negotiations and resulted in caused a different result than otherwise?
Well, I think that I don't dispute the possibility, Judge, but that's exactly the point. It could have, would have, maybe. There's no evidence, so we don't know.
I'm sorry. Go ahead and complete your point if you wish.
Well, yeah, without knowing, it's not fair to appellant to have the district court make an assertion that the state was prejudiced without. First of all, the case law is clear. I don't think anybody disputes the case law is fairly clear. The state has the burden of proof regarding the fourth Chesky factor. That's clear cut black letter case law. So there's a burden of proof, and your burden is not met by me saying in my written submission, hey, I was prejudiced because this, that, and the other thing happened. And maybe my plea negotiation was hindered by this, that, and the other thing happening. We don't know. And without knowing, it's unfair for the district court to make that logic or that presumption that there was prejudice. So the fact that it might have caused the plea negotiation to be derailed isn't enough. The respondent has a burden of proof, and there's no proof. That's our issue. There's no proof. And even the district court's order kind of agrees with that, because what the order says on page 8, it's addendum 8, the state asserts that during the time was delayed, a witness had to be relocated or whatever. But that assertion is not proof. And that's our issue with this process. And it's not just this case, but this is the case before this panel, where, and it happens all the time in civil litigation, an attorney shows up at a motion for summary judgment hearing and starts making assertions that they didn't support with evidence in the record. And so while it's certainly possible that the state was prejudiced, possible isn't enough. The mere possibility of prejudice doesn't carry the day in that Chesky factor. The state has a burden of proof, and not to hold them to the burden of proof when you're imposing a $200,000 forfeiture in a case that's been resolved by a plea agreement is not enough. It there needs to be some kind of threshold showing.
I'm not sure who's talking. My question is this. So if we agree with you, I assume you're suggesting the remedy for this court is to send it back to district court and have the bond fully reinstated. Is there a possibility that this court could fashion a different dollar amount? I say that because you are now going on to the $200,000 amount, as you called it, a penalty. What options are open to this court?
Well, certainly the court could remand this case for an evidentiary hearing, as suggested by the district court. You know, the state was the one who didn't come to the hearing, and then the district court takes issue with my client not presenting evidence about what the costs were incurred in trying to produce and apprehend the defendant. But it was the state who didn't want to have the hearing. We were there prepared to have our hearing. So you could remand it for an evidentiary hearing on the district court's question about, because the district court says the facts on the record find a partial reduction may be appropriate, but a calculation could better be determined if there was an evidentiary hearing and there was evidence taken about the cost for Midwest. So, you know, if the district court is considering, you know, how much it costs to try to enforce this bond for my client, you could remand it for an evidentiary hearing and further argument. But frankly, and I've had this argument in front of this court numerous times recently about what is an abuse of discretion in imposing a partial forfeiture. Where does the $200,000 figure come from, other than it's apparent in the district court's order that the district court was upset with Mr. Williams for his behavior in the court, citing his belligerence in person hearings and having been held in contempt, and then disregarding her order to appear in person and appearing by Zoom. It's our read of the court's order that this is a punishment. And, you know, indirectly, I guess Mr. Williams and his indemnitors are punished because we're going to have to chase them down if my client's required to pay this amount into the state coffers. But what other purpose does this partial reinstatement of discharge do than to punish the surety and Mr. Williams' indemnitors and increase the revenue of the state? There's really no rational connection between a $200,000 forfeiture and what I call, as Judge Smith says, I call a penalty, because I don't think you can call it anything else. And
Mr. McGinney, I want to go back to the fourth factor. Isn't it true that the briefing schedule allowed your client an opportunity for a rebuttal or a reply, and that you did not file one, right? I mean, you could have filed a reply challenging either the form of the state's evidence of prejudice. You could have said, you know, a letter is insufficient. It has to be admissible evidence. And secondly, you could have introduced evidence that the teenage minor child witness was not relocated or was available. But you didn't do that. And so now you're coming to us on appeal and saying, I think you're challenging the form mostly in your briefing anyway. But am I correct? You had an opportunity to do that in the district court and did not?
I think you're partially correct, Your Honor. I don't think we had an opportunity to come back and present more evidence. I think the evidentiary record is closed. In civil procedure, briefing is done after the evidence is presented to the district court. And so we had rested on our evidence that was presented, which was our affidavit, which went unrefuted by respondents' trial counsel. So I don't think we had an opportunity to come back and reinvestigate where this child witness was or those kinds of issues. Yes, I probably could have submitted a reply brief in opposition to the assertions about prejudice, but we didn't. And I don't know that, again, it's speculation about whether that would have changed the district court's mind in their order. It's almost like asking the court to reconsider its finding or conclusion that the state had been prejudiced. I think the court had already made up its mind.
So if the prosecutor had filed two documents, one was this letter brief, and then secondly, she filed an affidavit in which she said the same thing, that the teenage minor child witness was relocated and whereabouts unknown. Would you have any argument in that event?
I see I'm out of time if I can answer the question.
Yes, of course.
If we had been served some evidence in during the briefing period, we would have contacted the court and asked the record be allowed to be reopened to do our own investigation regarding those assertions. But there was no affidavit ever filed, just the assertion in a written submission. So I think that would have triggered a request to reopen the record and have an evidentiary hearing. And I see I'm out of time. I'll reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes, appears there are no further questions at this time. You will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Scott Hersey, Special Assistant Crow Wing County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this bond forfeiture appeal. And before making my argument, I would like to just address a couple of things that Mr. McGeaney brought up. And one was, of course, as the court pointed out, that he had the chance, according to the district court judge, to file a responsive brief to the state's brief and chose not to do so. Further, he could have made objections to the form of the statements that the state had made in its letter brief and did not do so. And I would submit that it was, in fact, properly submitted. And in fact, the transcript of that hearing, I believe on August 24th, indicated that Mr. McGeaney had said, it's fine to brief this. That seems reasonable to me. And then they worked out a briefing schedule, which included the opportunity for a reply. And therefore, I would submit that these facts were properly represented to the court by an officer of the court, and that was the original assigned prosecutor that submitted that letter brief.
Mr. Hersey, did the district court's briefing schedule or the district court's provision for further submissions, did that also permit the introduction of additional evidence, say in the form of an affidavit in connection with the briefs?
I don't believe so, Judge. From reading the transcript, as this court certainly has done, I got the impression that the parties were submitting their arguments in the form of briefs or letter briefs rather than having an actual hearing. And I might point out also that there was not a request for any further evidentiary hearing by the appellant in this particular case. So I think the impression of everyone is that the parties would present their arguments and the facts that they had available in the written submissions to which the appellant had agreed. And I would point out also that Rule 7.02 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, I believe, would provide for this. And a bail forfeiture, as Mr. McGeaney pointed out, is treated as a civil proceeding. And the parties are allowed under that rule to forego a hearing and oral arguments and simply submit writings. And finally, I would suggest that under a published case of this court, State versus Due, DUE, 472 Northwest 2nd 276 from 1988, the Court of Appeals in that case said the district court made its decision on the surety's affidavit and on the state's oral and written argument. So I would respectfully submit that that case is precedent for the judge allowing the parties to submit their facts in their arguments, as opposed to doing an additional document, which is an affidavit, which simply would recite the same thing. And I would also submit that even without prejudice in this case, the state had adequately proved the first three Shefsky factors favored the forfeiture and only partial reinstatement. And I would point out that both Minnesota Statute 629.59 and Shefsky itself from the Minnesota Supreme Court give the district court very broad discretion and wide latitude whether to reinstate and discharge a forfeited bond or do that partially. And the statute says the district court may forgive or reduce the penalty according to the circumstances of the case and the situation of the party on any terms and conditions the court considers just and reasonable. And as both parties agree, this is a case where the standard of review is abuse of discretion. And I would respectfully suggest that the district court did not abuse its discretion in its findings on each of the Shefsky factors. And I noted also that the district court in its memo cited State versus Storkamp, that the bail statutes are remedial and are to be liberally interpreted. And the first three Shefsky factors.
Mr. Hersey, I'm sorry to interrupt. Sorry to interrupt you. I'm looking for, okay, I think the Dewey case, I found it. I apologize. You may.
Thank you. I would like to just briefly go through the Shefsky factors and the findings of the district court in this particular case. The first is the purpose of the bail statute, the civil nature of the matter, and the cause and length of the absence. And this is a case where the defendant was specifically informed with a notice that was in bold, capital letters, highlighted that this was to be an in-person hearing. Yet the defendant chose not to do that and did not appear in person and made some attempt to appear by Zoom. Further, besides just not appearing, he absconded for over 6 months, and there was nothing that Midwest Bonding did that facilitated his arrest. He was, in fact, arrested by law enforcement officers based on a citizen complaint and ended up with new charges. And further, while he was out on absconding, at least, he did commit new additional felonies by making contact with a protected person under the Danko. So I would submit that factor does favor the district court's forfeiting the bail. The second factor is the bad faith of the defendant attributed to the surety. And that's very clear in Shefsky and the following cases. There was a clear directive by the court that the defendant had to appear in person. He ignored that, tried to appear by Zoom. He was gone for 6 months. And he made repeated actions that actually challenged the authority and the orders of the court. On July 20th, he was held in contempt of court for his behavior in the hearing. On August 5th of 21, he filed documents stating that the court's actions were void. On December 2nd of 21, he sent a letter to the court telling the court to use his birth certificate as a bond. And on February 2nd of 19. Of 2022, he filed a copy of the forfeiture order that had been signed by the court and signed it claiming that he had some type of private indemnity bond. And then, of course, on July 20th and 21st, the additional charges resulted from his contacting the protected party several times, despite the Danko, almost immediately. The court order was issued on July 20th. On July 20th and 21st, he contacted the protected party. And then, of course, on March 21st, of 22, he was arrested at the home of the protected party under the Danko. So I would submit that factor.
Mr. Hersey?
Yes.
Does the district court have to give any kind of rationale as to how they arrived at the 200,000 figure?
As I read the case law, Judge, I don't believe the court has to specifically go through and express its analytical process. The cases that I have looked at, both published and unpublished, focus on whether the district court properly exercised its discretion and analyzed the all four Shetsky factors without giving any one of them undue prominence or saying that one of the factors would trump the other ones. And that's how I read the number of cases that we have here. And so
does it make a difference that this was an unconditional bail as opposed to a bail with conditions? Does that make a difference?
It should not, Judge, because even an unconditional bail doesn't allow a person to disobey a Danko. That is a separate crime. And of course, the defendant was charged with an additional 12 counts for immediately violating the Danko. And then he had been later charged with another violation of the no contact order when he was arrested on March 21st of 2022 at the protected person's home. So the Danko exists separately, and I believe legally that's how that works. And I would submit that those facts clearly demonstrate the bad faith, and as Shetsky says, that's attributed to the surety. As to the third Shetsky factor, the good faith of the surety, the surety did take certain steps, and Mr. McGinney laid out what those steps were, but I would submit that they were minimal and had really no effect on causing the apprehension of the defendant, who was apprehended by law enforcement officers. Mr. McGinney indicated that the surety used the telephone numbers that it had to try and contact the defendant. When that didn't work, they did a internet search of the jails in Minnesota to see if he had been reapprehended. And then they also hired a recovery agent. But the recovery agent basically said they did about the same thing. They tried to look at the contacts to see if they could find the fellow, and they used investigative software. But there was no detailing in any of appellant's submissions about what specifically that recovery agent did or what expenses were incurred by the surety in hiring that recovery agent. And that has been criticized in other cases, including State versus Vang, which I cited in my brief. And because there was no document of the expenses or all of the actions that were taken by either the surety or the recovery agent, I would say that there was very little done and the good faith of the surety was not proven adequately. And finally, prejudice to the state, I'll touch on that very briefly. Again, this was a significant delay. This was 6 months. It wasn't 2 weeks, it wasn't 2 months, but 6 months of a delay in a case is significant. Secondly, as a district court found, as the assigned prosecutor recited in her letter brief to the court, the juvenile eyewitness had been relocated by the family and they had been unable to find that person. And finally, I think it should not be overlooked that as a matter of prejudice, the defendant committed new crimes. And while he was absconding, he was still seeing the protected person and ended up getting charged additionally. So I would submit that all four of the Shetsky factors weigh in favor of denying the full reinstatement. And even though Midwest Bonding provided no itemization of the expenses and did not do anything that resulted in the apprehension of the defendant, it is highly unlikely that its expenses amounted to $100,000. And in the numerous cases on this particular topic, I don't see any of them even coming close to a figure like that. And I doubt that Midwest Bonding expended that amount. And I think that is a factor that has gone into the good faith of the surety in the Shetsky factors. And I think the district court actually was generous in giving back a full third of the amount of the forfeited bail. And so I submit that the court properly analyzed that issue and that factor, and it did not abuse its discretion. And granted, Court of Appeals decisions that are unpublished or non-precedential do not bind this court. But I would ask the court to simply take a look at some of the decisions of this court where they have upheld the withholding of a substantial portion of the bond and not reinstated the entire bond. And one was State versus LGELGY A18-2058, where they upheld the forfeiture of 75% of the bond. Another was State versus Roberson A21-0862, where The court upheld the forfeiture of 50% of a $325,000 bond. And then in State versus Aiden, A20-0584, a series of consolidated cases. In one of them, the court upheld the forfeiture of two-thirds of a $75,000 bond. So I would submit that there is significant deference to the judgment of the district court in deciding how much of the bond should be returned. And a lot of it depends on the extent of the efforts made by the surety. And here, I would suggest that they were very minimal. And I would suggest that the court was extremely generous in reinstating $100,000 of the bond. And I see that Mr. McGeaney has basically suggested that the district court was erroneous by deciding that the omnibus hearing on September 13th of 2021 should have been in person. But in light of the original contempt proceeding at the very first hearing, and in light of the fact that the hearing immediately preceding the omnibus hearing, the defendant's connection had been so poor, the court did order that that was to be an in-person hearing. And I believe that the court certainly has that authority under Rule 105 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure. And in light of that, and in light of the defendant's total disregard of that clear directive, I would submit that that shows bad faith. So,
Mr. Hersey?
Yes.
Assuming for the moment that the court believes that the prosecutor's factual statement about unavailability of a witness that was contained in the letter brief, assuming that that is not properly, was not properly before the district court, and therefore the district court's analysis of the fourth factor was infected by that mistake, what would the appropriate approach be or the remedy be for this court in light of that, if that were the court's view?
Judge, I would suggest that reinstating the entire bond would not be the appropriate remedy for that assumption. But if the court decides that the form of the information communicated to the district court, which the district court relied on, should have been in another format, such as affidavits, then the proper remedy would be to remand for an evidentiary hearing, which would, in fact, give Mr. McGeaney the opportunity to bring out more detail about the actions of the surety and the recovery agent. And it would allow the state to simply turn around and take those same facts that were presented to the district court and put them in affidavit form. But to just finish my answer again, I would submit that based on the transcript of the August 24th hearing, that the parties were under the impression that they could submit their arguments in writing and add their facts to it. And again, there was no rebuttal or objection by appellant to that process.
Your time has expired. You may sum up if you wish.
I would simply point out to the court that the district court properly applied the four Shetsky factors and did not abuse its discretion by returning $100,000 of the forfeited bond. I would submit that Midwest Bonding did not meet its burden of proof on the first three Shetsky factors, yet the state did prove that it was prejudiced by the six-month delay, by the loss of a witness, and by the defendant committing additional felonies, which is not in question. Therefore, I would be asking this court to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Hersey. Mr. McGeaney, you have an opportunity for rebuttal argument. You're muted, Mr. McGeaney.
The wonders of Zoom. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start just rebutting the last assertions by counsel that the bonds should be forfeited for allegations that this defendant committed new offenses. This was an unconditional appearance bond. These bonds, and it's in the bond form 702, specifically state that bail bonds do not assure a defendant's behavior and assure that they're going to remain law abiding. And, you know, these new charges against Mr. Williams, he's presumed innocent, and they're not, it's not proper for them to be considered in a bail bond reinstatement argument that the defendant is alleged to have committed new crimes. In addition, you know, I would, regarding the first factor, the defendant appeared at the hearing. Granted, he didn't appear at the, in the form that the district court wanted or ordered. The fact remains that he did appear. And so
the district court called it a failure to appear, correct?
Correct. The district court called it a failure to appear. But for the Schatzky argument, makes this case somewhat unique in that they're calling it a willful failure to physical appear when he appeared on Zoom when we were during the period where the district courts were operating extensively on the Zoom platform. So I just want to point that out, that this isn't a case where the offender just merely did not appear for the hearing. He appeared on Zoom. And again, it's, I think it's another more evidence that the district courts forfeiting 2/3 of this bond are because the district court's angry and it's a form of penalty or punishment. But frankly, by the way, why I concentrated on this allegation or assertion in the state's memo about lost witnesses causing their prejudice, all these other assertions in the written submission are not supported by evidence either. You know, frankly, the state's argument that the defendant was apprehended by the police, no evidence of that in the record. I don't doubt that to be true, but there's no evidence in the record of that. You know, the fact that the offender was apprehended at the protected person's address, again, as an assertion by the prosecutor in her letter to the court, it may or may not be true, but there's no evidence in the record. And again, it's problematic where these assertions are being made. I don't know that Rule 702 has anything to do with creating a factual record in the district court by merely asserting it in a written submission. I think the case law and the rules are clear in the Minnesota courts that in a civil proceeding, the way to present evidence to the district court in matters like this are either through a sworn statement, an affidavit, or testimonially. You could call witnesses and testify to the facts. You can't put evidence in. You can't say that by agreeing to a briefing schedule, we agreed that I could make factual assertions in my brief that are going to be held as true by the district court. That's just not the process in civil proceedings. And I would respectfully disagree with counsel's assertion that by agreeing with a briefing schedule, we necessarily conceded that the respondent could make factual assertions in their submission that the district court could just presume are true.
Mr. McGinney, if the prosecutor had submitted an affidavit along with her letter, and I understand your prior statement that additional evidence was not permitted at that time, but if the prosecutor, let's say if the prosecutor had timely submitted an affidavit stating that the witness had relocated, would you have any argument that she was not a proper witness for that fact, or that that she was not competent to so testify?
I guess that's a hard question to answer. I don't know. But if we had received an affidavit from the prosecutor regarding a witness's unavailability, we would have investigated it, contacted victim witness, find out who the witness was, how relevant were they to the case, were they an essential witness to the prosecution, were they in fact relocated. We would have done more investigation. So I don't know that I can say yes or no. Again, I don't know that that witness would have the foundation to make that assertion. She may or may not have, but because it didn't happen, we just don't know. So I think that would have probably triggered some additional litigation for sure. And in fact, you know, would have been investigated by our client with the resources they have available to them. I want to end with, and I'm out of time, you know, I agree that there are numerous cases, unpublished decisions, where panels of this court have upheld significant forfeitures on the premise that it's not an abuse of discretion. And, you know, where do you draw that line? I think Judge Smith touched on it. So in the same set of circumstances, one district court judge could reinstate and discharge $290,000 of this bond, and that would be within its discretion. And in another circumstance, a judge can reinstate and discharge $100,000 or $50,000 of a $300,000 bond, and that's within their discretion. Where does the latitude stop, especially in facts of this case, where the defendant appeared, albeit on Zoom? The bond wasn't ordered forfeited for quite some time after that, in a proceeding, by the way, that's outlined in my facts that was improper, we believe, without notice to my client in the district court action, that where the bond was forfeited, we weren't received notice of the hearing. And then in a case like this, where the briefing and the arguments made were without factual evidential support. And with that, I see I'm out of time, unless the panel has questions that you'd like me to answer.
It appears not. So the case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days, as usual. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is now submitted.
Thank you. Have a good day, everybody.